But most of us go on to be blacksmiths and bricklayers, far away from any real adventure. I was a lucky one. Kingdoms come to the schools looking for the toughest boys for their royal guard. Had to undergo a whole lot of tests to prove my loyalty to good. In the end, Camelot and Foxwood both wanted me. Foxwood's home, but I couldn't turn down a chance to serve King Arthur's kingdom. His expression changed. Foxwood's been under attack by a band of trolls, though. Dad's a footman for the king. Troll set fire to his carriage and snapped his arm in two. Can't work anymore. So I've been sending my wages home so he can feed my mum and sisters. No one knows who these trolls work for. Mum wrote, asking if Camelot was going to intervene. Lots of kingdoms asking the same question, she says. He glanced hopefully at the young king. Tedros stood straighter.
I'm calling a summit.
The guard stared at him.
A summit.
Get all our allies together and build an army, Tedros said authoritatively. That's what kings do.
Oh. The hope went out of the guard's eyes. And here I grew up with legends that your dad stormed into battle bare-chested and slayed villains himself, he said.
Made up stories, I bet. He must have called summits, too.
Can't always trust a pen to tell the truth, can you? Tedros looked at him, but they were at the end of the stairway now. The guard pointed down a long, dark hall.
Prison's this way, Your Highness.
I'll go on my own, said Tedros.
But I should take you.
My meeting with the prisoners is a private one, guard,
said Tedros, eager to be alone again.
You may return to your post.
The guard hesitated.
Are you sure?
Go, said Tedros sharply. Close the door behind you. That's an order.
The guard didn't flinch.
As you wish.
Tedros watched him go.
Guard.
The man turned.
What's your name?
Tedros asked. The guard looked surprised.
It's Kay, Your Highness.
Tedros gazed right at him.
I promise to make your home safe again, Kay.
Kay smiled.
I'll tell my mum, Your Highness. Kings don't often make promises they can't keep.
Tedros watched him hustle back up the stairs. He waited until he heard the echo of a heavy door closing and the thud of stone. Then, the young king stepped off the staircase and moved into the hall, the glint of his crown fading into darkness. Tedros thought the advisers might be dead. Moving through the stale dungeon, he'd cast his gold finger glow on empty cell after empty cell, seeing nothing but mould-speckled walls, desiccated roaches, and rows of thick iron bars. Rulers didn't make a habit of trapping criminals inside the bowels of their own castles, but in most kingdoms, good or evil, town jails were overcrowded, unsecured, and rife with corruption. Indeed, the one and only time the Sheriff of Nottingham caught Robin Hood, the rogue escaped the Sheriff's prison. Kings and queens had learned to house their most significant enemies under their own roofs. But as Tedros approached the last cell, he couldn't hear a peep from the advisers, not a word, or a breath, or a snore. Had something happened to...
Long live the so-called king, sang a low, smoky voice.
Long live the cowardly lion,
sang a high, jingly voice. Long live the worthless son, sang a hissy third.
Tedros took a deep breath, pausing in front of the pitch-dark cell. Not dead, after all. He lifted his glow, lighting up the inside. Three old women leered back at him, each an identical replica of the other. Bristly salt and pepper hair hung down to their waists, their stick-thin legs jutting out of tattered grey tunics. Their skin was shriveled and coppery, their necks and faces elongated with high foreheads, slim noses, match-thin lips, and almond-shaped eyes. Tedros thought they looked like pale versions of the mandrill monkeys that defiled his coronation.
"A few more wrinkles since the last time you saw us," said the low-voiced one. "Alpa, especially."
"If anyone's lost their looks, it's you, Bethna," said the high-voiced one. "Besides, we didn't see much of the young prince before he went off to school. Avoided us like poison once we became his father's advisers. Omida, especially."
"Maybe because I'm the prettiest," said the hissy one. "Our little Tedros doesn't like pretty girls. Just look at his princess. Got a good peek at her when she came to the castle."
"We all did," said Bethna.
"Before we were illegally jailed by that hideous knight,"
Alpa scorned. "Proof Tedros is his mother's son, at least," rasped Omida. "They share poor taste in mates."
The three hags cackled. Tedros kept his cool. He'd had experience with covens trying to rile him up.
"Reason I avoided you when I was younger is because I didn't trust you,"
he said glacially.
"For years you'd been standing on stoops in Camelot Square, preaching against my father. You called him Merlin's puppet. You called my mother a two-faced tramp. You demanded Excalibur be returned to the stone and a new test held to find the one true king. The king so strong and powerful he would reign forever. The king who would make Camelot great again."
Heat seared Tedros's cheeks.
"No one listened to you. Everyone knew Camelot was already great because of its king, because of my father. No one thought of three Mistral sisters as anything other than demented, delusional freaks."
Bethna gripped the bars, gnashing uneven teeth.
"Then why did your father bring us here?"
"Because after my mother and Merlin left him, he became a paranoid drunk," Tedros retorted. "He started to trust the royal rot, and you. He fired all his old counselors, thinking they were spies for my mother, and he brought you into his castle as his advisers because some of the things you'd preached on your stoop had come true. He began to think that you could help him become that one true king you'd spoken of, a king of infinite power who could live forever. But instead, you used him and his kingdom and watched both die. Well, now it's my turn to watch you do the same."
Alpa exhaled, looking bored.
"Just like his mother, isn't he?"
"Only sees what he wants to see," said Bethna. "Never sees the whole picture," said Omida.
"If only he'd listened more closely to our stoop talks," said Alpa.
"Like his father did," said Bethna. "Then he wouldn't be in this predicament, would he?" said Omida.
Tedros had enough.
"I've seen the ledgers. The Camelot Beautiful funds are a fraud. You took all our gold and hid it somewhere."
"Check our pockets,"
Alpha quipped. Give us a good frisk, Bethna said.
Tee-hee.
Omida giggled. Tedros felt his ears smouldering.
If you don't tell me where you hid it, I'll...
Shouldn't you be asking Lady Gremlane?
Alpa mused.
She's the one up there while we've been down here minding our own business. Ask her.
If you can find her, said Bethna. Her sisters snickered. Tedros furrowed. They knew his steward had left the castle. How? She'd only been gone a few hours. Unless... Kay had said Lady Gremlane had the only other key to the prison. Had she been secretly in cahoots with these three this whole time? Had she deliberately been stonewalling Tedros meeting them? It was such an obvious idea. The advisers were the ones who'd brought her back to the castle, yet he'd never considered it until now. Lady Gremlane had been so loyal to Camelot these past 6 months. Had his mother been right to mistrust Lady Gremlane all this time? He had to find out what happened between his mother and his steward when his father was alive.
See that, Bethna? He's thinking, Alpa said.
Like a candle without a flame, Bethna piped. Should stick to what he's good at, Omida chipped in.
What's that?
Said Alpa quizzically.
Nothing,
said Omida. The trio tittered.
Shut up,
Tedros barked.
You set up the Camelot Beautiful Fund long before Lady Gremlane returned to the castle. You gave the orders to hide Camelot's money in that fund. And you know exactly where the money went.
Indeed,
said Alpa, slouched against the bars, biting her blackened nails.
To an endeavour far beyond the comprehension of your puny pea-brain.
Tedros grabbed her by the throat through the bars, his fingers pressing into her larynx.
Tell me, or I'll kill you.
Touchy, touchy.
Alpa wheezed. Even that ugly knight behaved better, sneered Bethna, sidling beside her.
Go ahead. Kill all of us,
said Omida, flanking Alpa's other side.
But it would be a very poor decision. Things are just beginning, little boy.
At the forepoint, the real story begins,
said Alpa.
Forepoint, Tedros said urgently. What about the forepoint?
You'll need us when he comes, said Bethna.
Who? Your white knight?
Tedros mocked.
In 6 months, no one has tried to rescue you. No loyal spies have tried to kill me. No one has made a peep over your arrest. So tell me, sisters freaks, who is coming that will make me need you?
The sisters leaned in, grinning.
The snake, they hissed.
It hit Tedros like a blow to the chest. He let go of Alpa's throat, fumbling for words.
You know who he is.
Your father did too,
Alpa offered.
That's why he gave you your test, said Bethna. A test you failed.
Omida cracked. They hewed together like a three-headed serpent.
War is coming, little boy.
Alpa crowed. War between the lion and the snake, said Bethna.
The winner will be the one true king,
Omida added. They jammed their faces between bars.
The one with Arthur's blood.
Tedros felt nauseous. His heart sucked into his throat. It was what the Lady of the Lake had told Sophie. The same two words.
I don't believe you, he said, faking calm. No one has Arthur's blood besides me.
The snake does,
Alpa corrected.
You're lying, Tedros attacked.
Bethna yawned. Only a half-wit confuses lying with the withholding of information.
Tell me then, Tedros pressured. Tell me who the snake is.
Tell you where the money is, tell you who the snake is. Tell, 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 tell,
Alpa mimicked.
Besides, it's obvious, Bethna taunted.
Staring at you right in the face, said Alpa.
Only you don't want to see it, said Omida. Should we spoon-feed the poor boy? Bethna simpered to her sisters.
Only if he feeds us better food,
Alpa proposed, picking up a brass cup of murky water off a rusty tray in the corner of the cell. She shunted the tray towards Tedros, under the cell door. It had a bowl of gruel, crawling with ants.
Done, said Tedros.
Ham and mashed potatoes?
Said Alpa, wide-eyed.
Done.
Chicken livers and wine, said Bethna, hopefully.
Done.
Caviar and rampion salad?
Said Omida, breathless.
Done, done, done. You have my word,
Tedros hurried, his face glowing red.
Tell me who the snake is. Now!
Tell him, Alpa, Bethna sighed. Alpa sipped her water, eyes on Tedros. Then she stalked towards him, step by step.
Should have just asked your mousy old mum. She knows everything, no matter how dumb she plays.
She crooned, glaring hard.
But a deal is a deal, little boy. You want to know who has Arthur's blood? Then listen closely.
She slipped her face through the cell bars, her nose almost touching his.
The snake's name is...
She splashed her dirty water in his face.
Ring a king of bees will sting, so dance a timber-tumber!
Her sisters screeched laughter.
Fools! Tedros spat, wiping his face. You're as crack-brained as you were when you were raving on your stoops for coins. Let's see how you do with no food for a week.
He kicked the tray back under the bars, sending bowl and gruel flying, and the women cowering. Vibrating with anger, Tedros turned for the stairs.
No one in this world has my father's blood but me. You hear me? No one. No uncle, or brother, or sister.
Or son?
Tedros stopped dead in his tracks. He whirled back towards the cell, staring into its dark, empty silence.
What did you say?
He breathed. He lit up the cell with his glow, but the sisters had flattened against opposing walls with cat-like smiles.
What did you say?
He shouted.
Bush Banana Poo the Panda,
sang Alpa. The three mistrels danced like hags around a cauldron.
Bush Banana Poo the Panda!
Tedros slammed the bars, yanking at the door, trying to get inside.
What did you say?
But the three sisters just hopped and sniggered as Tedros ripped at their door the way he had his father's sword, until at last he showed his teeth through the bars.
I'm going to kill the snake, he vowed. And then I'm going to kill you.
He raged down the hall and up the stairs, breathing fire. Tedros threw his weight against the stone door. It didn't move.
Kay!
He wasn't waiting to build an army. He wasn't waiting for summits or wizards to be a king. He wasn't waiting for anything anymore. He'd ride to the Four Point right now and find this snake. Blood pumping, Tedros pummeled the door, drowning out the cackles from the dungeon below. Tonight, the lion would roar.
Chapter 17. Sophie. The Map Room. Sophie should have been thinking about the snake. The snake that had Arthur's blood. The snake that had terrorized the woods. The snake that had killed their friend and would kill them next. And yet, she couldn't stop thinking about hydrangeas. The whole castle's crawling with them, she whispered to Agatha, nodding at the thousands of pom-pom-shaped flowers in pink, purple and yellow, blanketing every inch of Castle Jolie.
I loathe hydrangeas, Aggie. They look like human brains. Just being around them makes me faint.
Shh! Agatha snapped, then kept on whispering to Nicola. Sophie stewed as the chain gang pulled her along deeper into the royal castle. The young pirate named Thiago, with the tattoos around his eyes, leading them on foot. The other pirates had remained outside the castle on their horses, sneering down at the crew as they shambled through the open doors like dead men walking to the gallows. Sophie watched the boys deliver each kid a demeaning kick in the bum. Hester, Anadil, Dot, Hort, Bogdan, Willem. But when it came to Sophie's turn, sunburnt Wesley simply smirked and gave her a frightening little hiss, which made it all the more foolish that with the snake moments away, Sophie was offended by flowers. But it wasn't really the hydrangeas that were bothering her, though she did hate everything about this castle, its birthday cake colours, its cloying candy cane scent, its treacly portraits of the royal children frolicking with dogs, and its endless loop of music playing Jean Jolie's annoyingly catchy anthem through flowered walls. Tipple top, joy and jaunt, come and be jolie. No, the real reason Sophie was annoyed was because she'd just saved everyone's noses in the pavilion with her brave performance, and no one seemed to care. Especially Agatha and Nicola, who kept whispering to each other like Flopsy and Mopsy. Sophie couldn't fault Agatha for having another friend. Aggie was perfectly free to consort with whoever she pleased, including a first-year reader with a bad attitude. So why, then, did Sophie feel so upset? She'd been so distracted by her reunion with Agatha and all the action of their new quest that she hadn't noticed a creeping emptiness returning. The same emptiness that had made her impatient with her students at school, increasingly bored with her dean's duties, and eager to comb Camelot's tabloids for sordid rumours about its new king. And yet, Sophie hadn't been able to put a finger on why she felt this way. She was happy being dean, wasn't she? That was the ever-after she'd worked so hard to find, and at the end of this quest she'd go right back to it, just like Agatha would go back to a wedding and a crown. Yet unlike Agatha, Sophie would have no one by her side. Well, at least not the way that Agatha had Tedros. But that was fine with her,
Truly. She might flirt with delectable ever-boys at parties and ogle a few of her own sultry never-boys during school assemblies, but she'd learned her lesson with Tedros and Rafal. No boy could ever really understand her. She was too strong and empowered and complicated. Boys always wanted her to change, and she didn't want to change. Not when she'd finally figured herself out. She'd be far better off staying out of that swamp for a long, long time. No, the only person Sophie needed was Agatha. Agatha understood her. Agatha balanced her. Agatha didn't expect her to change, which is why Sophie had been so happy these past few days with her best friend back in her life. But seeing Agatha confide in this Nicola girl the way Agatha had once confided in her made Sophie realize how fragile this happiness was. It was ironic, really. Agatha would have been happy living in Gavaldon forever with Sophie, but it was Sophie who had been determined to leave and find her own life. Now it was Agatha who had her own life. A life that didn't depend on Sophie any more. She heard Nicola whisper her name, and Sophie promptly goosed Agatha with her knee. "Are you two talking about me?" Agatha scowled. "We're talking about our plan to fight the snake. So now I'm not good enough to help you plan?" "I'll tell you the plan if you're quiet," Nicola said. "See how she talks to me?" Sophie mewled to Agatha. "Because you're acting like a mopstick," Agatha scolded. "You ungrateful Brutus! Not one word about how clever I was out there defusing those vile men. Not one word of appreciation." "Sorry, we've been busy planning how not to die. I remember when instead of gossiping about me with first years, it was me and you who made plans." "You are the plan, you idiot." "What?" Sophie blurted loudly. The chain yanked to a halt. Slowly the two girls looked up to see Thiago glaring daggers at them from the head of the line. Dark silence fell over the hall, punctured by gay sounds of singing, "Tippletop, joy and jaunt." The pirate stabbed his sword into a flowered wall, and the music squawked and petered out. He gave the girls a last glower of warning, and the death march resumed. Agatha and Nicola stared Sophie down. Sophie reddened. If she was indeed the team's plan to fight the snake, now she'd have to do it without knowing what the plan was. Steeling herself, she followed the line into the royal keep. The king and queen's private residence, as evidenced by the preponderance of children's bedrooms, cozy sitting rooms, and opulent bathrooms. Sophie peeked in, unnerved by an unmade bed, an open bottle of wine in one of the sitting rooms, a wooden toothbrush askew by the sink. Signs of life, but no one living there. At the front of the line, Hester coughed in surprise, snagging the chain. Sophie followed her eyes, as did everyone else. The library was coming into view, a two-floor yellow and pink rotunda cased in glass. Inside the library, three giant steel cages hung from the high ceiling, each packed to the brim with maids, guards, stewards, and members of the royal family. Two shirtless teen pirates, one thin and dark, the other hoggish with pig-coloured skin, were perched on the railing of the second floor. They took turns kicking the cages as hard as they could and watched them swing back and forth, tossing all the people inside like marbles while they screamed and cried, though Sophie couldn't hear any of it through the thick glass. The pirates looked bored. As one of them punted a cage, Sophie saw the King of Jaunt Jolie tumbling inside, his royal robe slashed and stained, his crown points speared with rotted fruit, as he tried to grip on to two bawling boys. The same little boys Sophie had seen playing with the dog in the foyer painting. The dog was cowering beneath a woman's blue gown in another cage, anticipating the next kick. The line pulled Sophie forward, and the library started to recede from view. Through the glass, she met the eyes of the king, who spotted her as his cage stopped swinging. His eyes watered as he clasped his hands, appealing to her for help, his tear-stained boys tucked at his sides. Sophie could only gawk back like a tourist in a sadistic museum, being pulled to the next display. "This man's wife has been killed for satchels of gold," she thought sickly. "Were these his boys?" Sophie felt her own eyes grow wet. "His now motherless boys?" Sophie thought of Honora's two young sons, just like these, who her father, Stefan, loved so much. Agatha elbowed her, and Sophie saw her best friend nodding subtly at the next cage about to be kicked, the one with the dog cowering beneath the woman in the blue gown. Only now, Sophie got a good look at the woman's petrified face and gasped. It was the same face they'd seen on that poster in the pavilion. The one stamped, executed. The Queen of Jaunt Jolie was alive? Astonished, Sophie and Agatha watched the Queen try valiantly to reach through her cage bars and touch her children and husband as their cage swung past. The chain jerked Sophie and Agatha forward, and the library was out of sight. Dragged ahead, Sophie thought back to the Lady of the Lake, who'd looked just as tortured as the Queen of Jaunt Jolie. The snake could have killed the sorceress in Avalon, but instead he drained her magic and left her feckless and afraid. He could have killed this queen too, but instead he peddled news of her death. And he could have left Avalon without a trace, but instead he'd left that map in Chadwick's hands to taunt them. He's always one step ahead, like Evelyn Sader and Rafal used to be, Sophie thought. And this one plays games too, just like them. An unsettling thought crossed her mind. But why? If he has Arthur's blood, if he thinks he can pull Excalibur, why play games? Sophie held her breath. Was it really Camelot's crown the snake was after? Or was he after something else? Something more? The line halted in front of her, and Sophie broke from her trance to see golden double doors at the end of the hall. They opened magically, revealing a room Sophie couldn't quite make out from this far back in line. Suddenly, her cuffs split open. So did Agatha's, and the piece of chain between them levitated into the air, turning black and shiny like an eel, before it flew off into the room, vanishing from view.
"You too," Thiago said, pointing a grubby fingernail at them. "Come here."
Sophie and Agatha clasped each other's hands. The tattooed pirate gestured ahead with his sword, directing the two girls through the gold doors. Holding hands tighter, Sophie and Agatha stepped out of line and entered the room. They looked back at the pirate and the rest of their friends still chained in the hall, gaping through the doorway.
"He's waiting," Thiago said darkly.
Agatha swiveled to Nicola, eyes wide. The door slammed shut, leaving Sophie and Agatha inside alone. Neither girl moved.
all that planning with your new friend?
Said Sophie softly.
And here we are, you and me, like always.
Agatha didn't answer. They peered around warily, expecting a trap. No one's here, Agatha said, letting Sophie's hand go. The first thing Sophie noticed about the room is that it was enormous, as vast and high as one of the ballrooms in the School for Good and Evil, lined with tall pillars. There were no doors, no windows, and no furniture, except for a long black stone table at the rear of the room. The second thing Sophie noticed was that the room was green. Whereas most of Jean Joly featured Easter egg hues, here the carpet, pillars, and walls were a deep, luminous emerald, textured with shiny, snake-like scales. The torches on the walls crackled with green flames. Sophie knew this colour well. It was the colour of her own eyes, as well as the colour of Rafal's old school that had sought to turn her good classmates evil. But here, it felt out of place, as if they'd passed through a portal into another realm. There was something that wasn't green, though, Sophie realized, looking upwards. 6 parchment maps floated in rows above the center of the room, each as big as a flag. It's a map room, said Agatha, moving towards them.
A what?
Said Sophie. Tedros showed me Camelot's on our first night in the castle. It was where his father used to meet with his round table. It had floating maps of neighboring kingdoms just like this. Tedros couldn't wait to hold meetings there with his knights, but he never got the chance. Sophie saw sadness in her friend's eyes, but there was no time for that now.
Do you recognize any of the maps at least? I don't see labels on them, she said, gripping one by its corner and holding it while it tried to sail off like a balloon. This one looks like Avalon. See, here's the sea around the kingdom, and the big gates, and the lake.
Her throat closed up.
Aggie?
The map had a 3-dimensional toy figurine positioned on top of the lake. The same exact figurine they'd seen on her and Professor Dovey's enchanted maps. The figurine was labeled Chaddick. His name crossed out. Stomach fluttering, Sophie let go of the map and rushed to catch hold of the next. More figurines inched across black, rocky terrain. Ruven, Arachne, Drax. Agatha grabbed onto a map with clear-coloured mountains. Kiko, Giselle, Hero. Another with purple hills had Vex, Brone, Mona.
They're our quest maps, said Sophie,
instinctively touching the gold vial on her neck to make sure it was still there. No wonder he knows our names and faces and could see us coming. No wonder the quests are going badly, Agatha said breathlessly, watching Kiko's figurine inch across the map.
Sophie, he can track all our moves. That's how he sent thugs to every kingdom and sabotaged their quests. But I thought Kiko's and Vex's teams were missing, said Sophie.
Not missing, just not responding to Dovey's messages, said Agatha, glancing between maps.
But why do all the teams seem to be moving in the same direction?
Sophie jumped up and snagged the next map, spotting a peanut-shaped shoreline, a pavilion on a hill, and a pastel-coloured castle.
"Here's Jean Joly," she said, spotting figurines labelled Sophie and Agatha against the castle, while Hester, Anna Del Dot, Bogdan, Nicola, and Hort were moving out the back of the castle in a single-file line through what looked like the royal gardens.
"The pirates are taking them somewhere," Sophie said.
Her eyes flared. On the opposite side of the castle, far from the pirates and the captive crew, she saw three more blue-labeled names on the map, lurking in a forest. Beatrix, Rena, Millicent.
Sophie,
Agatha choked. Sophie spun around. Agatha was holding onto the maps with Kiko's and Vex's teams, one with each hand, both threatening to tug her off the ground. Gritting her teeth, she muscled them like puzzle pieces next to the one Sophie was holding.
"Look at where they're going," said Agatha.
For a moment, Sophie didn't understand. Then she saw it. The missing quest teams were each headed towards a corner of their maps. So was Ruvan's team. So was the crew of the Igraine. Four teams. Four corners. All meeting at the same point, a short distance from where Sophie's and Agatha's figurines stood now.
"The forepoint," said Agatha.
"They're all going to the forepoint." She looked at Sophie. "Which means the snake's thugs didn't just sabotage their quests. They must have kidnapped them, too. That's why they aren't responding to Dovey. Because all of them are in the snake's hands." The two girls slowly raised their eyes to the only map left, floating over their heads. Tedros. Alone in Camelot. Agatha stiffened.
"We don't even know if these maps are real," Sophie argued quickly. "Dovey said only the Storian can make a quest map. How can the snake have the Storian's maps? This could be more hocus-pocus to scare us, just like he lied about killing the queen."
But Agatha wasn't paying attention any more.
"Listen," she said.
A soft scratching sound filled the room, like a cat clawing at a window. It was coming from the black stone table against the back wall. The two girls approached, their shoes padding on the green carpet. A gold-covered book lay open on the table. Hovering above, a magical pen drew on a blank page, a painting of the two girls as they were right now, gazing at a black pen, drawing in a storybook. The book on the table looked just like the one in the schoolmaster's tower that held their new fairy tale, and the pen floating over it drew in the same bold colours and clean lines as the Storian. Only this pen didn't look like the Storian, Sophie thought, peering closer. It was black, for one thing, not silver, and it wasn't steel like the Storian. It was flexible and eel-like, as if made out of sticky black goo, contorting with every stroke. It looked a lot like the piece of chain that had magically released her and Agatha before it flew into this room. Plus, the pen didn't have those strange symbols carved into its side either. Instead, it seemed to be covered in scales. Beneath the painting of the two girls, it wrote a caption. "One of them would die today. But which one?" Sophie saw the horror in Agatha's face.
"It's lying, Aggie. It's not the real story. It's not the story and..."
But Agatha was dead white, her eyes darting around the room. "This is how it happened before."
"What?"
"He wanted us to find this, Sophie, just like we did then."
"You're not making any sense.
This is how we met the schoolmaster. We found the pen and book on the table. The pen was drawing a picture of us that looked exactly like this one."
"Sophie, don't you remember?"
Agatha backed away from the storybook. "We were alone in a strange room just like this. We were standing just like this. The Storian began our fairy tale in front of our eyes. And then we heard the schoolmaster say behind us..."
"It must suspect a good ending,"
a voice echoed. The two girls froze. The voice came from behind them.
Chapter 18. Agatha. The pen that writes the truth. Agatha gripped Sophie's palm. The voice was low and crisp, definitely a man's. Holding tight, the two girls turned. At first, Agatha couldn't see anyone, the map room as quiet and deserted as when they came in. Then she saw him. He was camouflaged into a pillar hanging upside down, his body covered in the same shiny green scales as the rest of the room. His pose was like a lizard's, legs in a crouch, his torso flat against the column, with one hand outstretched and cupping the stone. Agatha could only make him out because of the whites of his unblinking eyes, glaring right at her, ice blue at the center. Sophie squeezed Agatha harder. Agatha knew why. Rafal had those eyes. He slithered down the column, his scales undulating along green stone like a snake through grass, his eyes never leaving the girls. As his hands touched the floor and he rose to stand, the scales on his body magically turned black, becoming snug black armor from neck to toe. He had Rafal's long and lean body, like a teenager's rather than a man's, muscles throbbing against his supple, skin-tight suit. His face, however, stayed green, his features obscured by the smooth, thick scales that shrouded his face like the schoolmaster's mask. As Agatha watched him come closer, her heart jumped. The scales on his face and body were moving. They rippled in gooey, wave-like ribbons that looked strangely similar to the pen writing in the storybook on the table. Only now there were hundreds of these scaly strips, like a mass of eels crisscrossing up and down, right and left, as if his body was made out of them. From the way Sophie was crushing Agatha's hand, it was clear she was seeing this too.
Rafal?
Sophie whispered. He circled them quietly, his well-built chest rising and falling with his breath, his scales gleaming in the green torchlight, until he spoke again.
Once upon a time, two girls wanted to find their way home. That was how your fairy tale began. All along, the pen sensed a good ending. Why else would it choose two readers to become legends?
His blue eyes sparkled through his mask.
And what an ending it was. One girl becomes good's next queen. The other becomes evil's future. And the boy they each loved becomes Camelot's lion.
He sounds like Rafal too, Agatha thought. But how? The schoolmaster was dead, his corpse shattered to ash by Tedros's sword. Her muscles locked. Unless the sword being stuck in the stone reversed the spell. Unless Tedros failing his test brought Rafal back. Can a sword do that?
But that's not how your story ends, he said, his tone sharpening.
He looked at Sophie.
You're not evil's future.
He looked at Agatha.
You're not good's next queen.
He looked up at the map with Tedros's name.
And he's not Camelot's lion.
He continued to circle.
You won't believe me, of course, because you trust the Storian, the pen that gave you a happy ending, the pen you think tells the truth.
His shoulder grazed Agatha's arm, and she felt the eels on his body squiggle across her skin. She swallowed a scream.
But just as there are two sides, with good and evil, with boys and girls, with old and new, there are also two sides to the truth. And until now, there's only been one pen. A pen that says, I am the snake. Come into the woods. I am the snake here to take down the lion. And you are the ones here to stop me.
He approached the black pen, dangling over its painting of the girls.
But what if there was a new pen? A pen that told a different truth.
The storybook rose into the air, tilting towards Agatha and Sophie. It began to flip backwards through pages, the captions beneath the paintings lit up in green glow. Agatha's heart fluttered as she saw a painting of Tedros, safe and sound, gathered with Merlin, Professor Dovey, Lancelot, and Guinevere at a dining table. But then she saw the caption. Back at Camelot, the snake plotted with his henchmen to keep his throne. The snake, Agatha blurted. Tedros.
Henchmen,
Sophie said. But the book had flipped back to a painting of Agatha and Sophie dragged through the pirate's pavilion on a chain. The two girls were led towards the castle to meet the lion.
You're not the lion, Agatha fought.
Only there were more paintings of Tedros and more captions. The snake tried again and again to pull King Arthur's sword, failing every time. The snake stood by and did nothing as kingdoms in the woods appealed for his help. The snake was a coward, so he let his princess take over his quest. But now the book returned to the very first page of its fairy tale. The painting of Chadwick, dead on Avalon's shore, precisely matching the image the Storian had drawn in its book. Except the caption was different. Once upon a time, a lion made its way into the woods. Its plan was simple. Take down the snake. The book snapped closed with a thundercrack, jolting the two girls before it plopped onto the table. It's lies, Agatha spat. All of it. That's the side you're on, truth versus lies. That's what this story is about, and you're the liar. Look at you! You're the snake!
You of all people should know better than to judge by looks, said the snake. But if you listened closely, I've already told you how this story will end. With your fairy tale shattered and the real story laid bare. With everything you thought true turned untrue.
But Tedros is the lion. You're the villain here, Agatha retorted. You have the whole story backwards, says your pen.
Mine says differently.
The snake spoke calmly, using his finger like a wand and lifting the scaly black pen into the air over the stone table. Silvery smoke trailed out of its tip, playing out scenes in front of the girls.
Your pen says Cinderella is about a kind girl rescued from her wicked family. My pen says Cinderella is about a clever dowager trying to save her daughters from poverty, only to see an intruder steal the life she planned for them. Your pen says Peter Pan is about a hero who saves his friends from a lethal pirate. My pen says Peter Pan is about a brave, hook-handed captain who defends himself against the children who mutilated him. Your pen says Rapunzel is about a fair maiden seeking to escape her cruel mother. My pen says Rapunzel is about a witch promised a child as repayment for a crime, only to see a man violate the terms of agreement.
The ghostly smoke curled into the silhouette of a silver mask, blue eyes blinking beneath.
And while your pen says the tale of Sophie and Agatha is about two girls battling an evil schoolmaster,
the pen's phantom mask turned green.
My pen says it's about a young man's soul traveling through generations who finally found true love with a girl, only to learn it was a lie.
The smoke dissipated, revealing the green-masked man behind it, his gaze on Sophie.
It's not possible, Sophie sputtered. Can't be back.
But from the way Agatha saw her looking at him, Sophie seemed to have no doubt he was.
It all comes down to this. Your pen thinks I'm the snake. My pen thinks I'm the lion. So which pen is right?
He asked.
Yours that writes lies?
He glared at the two girls, his black scaly pen spinning over his black scaly hand.
Or mine that writes the truth?
Instantly, all the scales of his body broke apart into a thousand eels, lifting off him like puzzle pieces and suspending in midair, so that for a moment his head was separated from this fractured body. The slimy eels squirmed as they floated, with no visible heads or tails, each one identical to the snake's pen, which now hovered right above where his heart should be. But most startling of all were their squeals, high-pitched and knifing, like the sound of amplified rats growing louder and louder, until Agatha and Sophie both cowered, shielding their ears. In a flash, the eels went quiet and flew back into formation, rebuilding his shiny black suit. The pen had become part of him. The snake loomed over the girls.
We'll see which is right in the end, won't we?
From the way his eyes shimmered, Agatha knew he was smiling. She could see Sophie's face change. There was something here Sophie didn't recognize, something that didn't match up with her once evil prince.
Who are you?
Sophie breathed. Agatha felt it too. The schoolmaster had been Good's greatest nemesis, but the schoolmaster believed in the Storian. The schoolmaster believed in its truth, or at least the same truth they did. This snake saw lies as the truth, and truth as lies. For a second, Agatha was back at school, trying to reconcile two sides that once seemed so clear, and were now blurring into one. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw the open book, lying on the table, the painting of her and Sophie lit by green torchlight. One of them would die today, but which one? More lies? Or was it the truth? Danger shot up Agatha's spine. Get out of this room. Get out of this room now. But how? She could feel a word flitting through her mind like a fly, trying to get her attention. She caught it. Plan. And yet you wear a mask, Agatha challenged.